Alright everybody, welcome back listeners. You're tuned in to yet another episode of South Sudan and the World, where we delve deep into compelling stories and insights from fascinating individuals shaping our world today. I'm your host, Akol Doc, and today we have a very special guest joining us. It's a pleasure to introduce you to our brother, Akol Mien, author, analyst, writer, commentator. If you've opened any newspaper in South Sudan, Arabic or English, you'll find his writings. If you want to know more some of his books, Sudan, Understanding the Oil-Rich Region of Abyei, The Last Train, The Sun Will Be Rising, many more. He's one of our best minds. Brother Akol, you're welcome.
Thank you, my name. Thank you. It's nice to be with you and share with you some of my humble, you know, contributions.
Okay. Thank you for joining us. Now, we see your writings. We see your work. We see your analysis and your activism. But we want to know, who is Akol? Tell us about your upbringing in your childhood.
Thank you for the question. I was born in Abyei, south of Abyei, in particular where the fighting has been taking place for the last 2 years. And then because of the insecurity within the Abyei area, I was taken to Khartoum by my mom in 1978. That is where I underwent my studies, primary school. And then after some time, I went back again to Abyei in 1981. But the fighting was still, you know, ongoing. You know, the Sudan Armed Forces and the Misiria have been, you know, attacking Abyei since I was a child. But something which started before I was born. So I had to go back to Khartoum at the end of 1982. So I stayed there in Khartoum, pursuing my studies, and then I went back to Abyei again in 1984. But at that time, the fighting escalated between the Ngok Dinka of Abyei, who were opposing the system of the Khartoum-based regimes, which were, you know, oppressing the Ngok Dinka people of Abyei. So I had to go back to Khartoum in May 1984, because I went back to Abyei in April 1984, but when the fighting escalated, I went back to Khartoum in 1984. So I continued pursuing my studies in Khartoum until I finished my primary school and intermediate school, or junior school for that matter. And then after that, I went to Sheikh Lutfi secondary school in Rufaa in Al Jazeera state. After that, I left the country in January 1993 for Egypt. So since that time until today, I have been moving around, but I took Nairobi, Kenya as my base. But I travel regularly based on the programs or conferences, or to visit the family members in South Sudan. But I visited Khartoum after the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2006. I visited my family. The extended family members were still in Khartoum. So, but during the time of the liberation struggle, I have been moving around within the SPLM, SPLA, liberated areas, you know, helping in one way or another. And I did some programs also with UNICEF and, you know, on educational programs. I also did some work for National Democratic Institute for International Affairs after the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. So my task was, you know, on the status of the implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And at the same time, I was also a regular contributor to BBC between 2001 until 2005. And I was also a columnist for a newspaper which was published in Kenya here, called the Sudan Mirror newspaper. May 2007, I was taken by the BBC Nairobi office as a full-time journalist. So I started working for BBC as a full-time journalist from May 2007 until I decided to go for an early retirement in 2017, just to focus on how to push the peace process in our country, how to engage the international community to support the peace process in South Sudan, and also to focus on writing, because when I was working for BBC, it was not possible to contribute to other publications due to conflict of interest, as you know that.
Okay, I mean, thank you for sharing. You have a very rich history, and you've done a lot in journalism, your work in BBC, and your work of activism in Sudan, South Sudan, and the voice you have been for the great people of Abyei. Now you're an accomplished writer. I've come across the works such as The Last Train, The Sun Will Be Rising. Tell us more about your writing. How did you get into writing books?
I started writing when I was in primary 5 in Khartoum. I started writing in Arabic. And then when I joined secondary school in Rufaa, I started to write in Arabic and English. And my English teacher used to publish my poetry poems on the board in school in Rufaa. But I started the serious publication of my humble works in, I think, in February 1992, when I was about to start my secondary school examinations. And so I sent my first poem in Arabic to an editor in Khartoum through a colleague who was traveling from Rufaa to Khartoum to visit his family members. So I asked him to deliver that poem to an editor of a Sudan al-Hadith newspaper in Arabic. And that poem was entitled Mataib. You can say Mataib is suffering, or, series of suffering, So it was published. From that time, when my first attempt to publish a poem in a prominent newspaper in Khartoum, it was an encouraging, moment. So from that time until today, I continued reading, writing, and publishing my humble works in various newspapers until, when I moved to Egypt in January 1993, I spent some time, a whole year, just reading and writing. But then from 1994, I started publishing my works in Al-Khartoum newspaper in Cairo, in Arabic, and also Sudan Al-Ittihad Al-Dawliya. Al-Ittihad Al-Dawliya used to be, a newspaper for the Sudanese Unionist Party, published in Cairo. And then later on, after 4.5 years in Egypt, I moved to East Africa, to Tanzania, and then to South Africa. Then I came back from South Africa to Tanzania. I spent almost 2 years in Tanzania, and I also did a little bit of writing there, but I didn't publish, in Tanzania. But the first collection of poems which was published, The Sun Will Be Rising, as you mentioned, it was published at the Catholic University of Eastern Africa in Nairobi, Kenya, in 2001. That book also encouraged me to continue writing, publishing, because it was warmly welcomed by my readers, especially our young Red Army members who were in Kakuma, and some of them who were in SPLM, SPLM liberated areas, plus the members of the New Sudan residing in East Africa here. So they got copies of that book, and also the Library of Congress of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi also contacted me in November 2001 asking for the book, and lastly they made some orders for the U.S. universities back there in the U.S., including the Library of Congress in Washington. So it was an encouraging moment also, and then I continued writing. So the second collection, The Last Train, came out in 2003. I published it in England, then followed by a book called A Case for the Capacity of South Sudanese to Rule Themselves. That book came out in 2009, and then after that, book on Abyei you mentioned a few minutes ago, Sudan Understanding the Oil-Rich Region of Abyei, in 2011. It came out in March 2011. And then after that, I published another book called Intizar, It is a collection of poems in Arabic. That book came out in 2017. After I left the BBC, I traveled to Cairo to publish it there, and then I also launched it in Cairo.
Okay.
In August 2017.
Okay, that's good. Now I want to talk about this book in particular, Sudan, Understanding the Oil-Rich Region of Ibie. Considering the events that have been happening, can you just give us a background of Ibie?
Ibie is the territory of the Nine Lord Dinka chiefdoms, and it was transferred by the British from Bahr Ghazal province in 1905 to Kordofan province during the time of the paramount chief of the Lord Dinka of Ibie, Arobio. The Lord Dinka were put under one administration in Kordofan with the Nasiri Arabs, who used to attack our areas, Ibie area, Twitch area, and Ruweng area. So this Twitch area plus Ruweng and Ibie were transferred to Kordofan. But then before the independence of Sudan in 1956, the Twitch and Ruweng were brought back, you know, to South Sudan, but Ibie remained in Kordofan. But then, you know, being under one administration in Kordofan could not stop attacks which have been carried out by the Nasiri Arabs on our areas. So in 1954, some young Ibie, you know, students who were studying in Egypt by then, including the late Dengbio, was among the people who protested, wanted Ibie to be taken back to South Sudan, particularly to Bahr Ghazal province. But those students, they were arrested when they came back to Sudan. They were arrested by the Sudanese government for asking for the return of Ibie to Bahr Ghazal region or province. But in November 1964, the Nasiri Arabs cut the limbs of our fellow from Awil, and they started to beat the drums with that with the hands which were cut. So the Lord Dinka people of Ibie became very angry, and that is how the major fighting, you know, started in December 1964 in Ngolkong is far east of Ibie region. So the Nasiri Arabs were helped by the Sudan Armed Forces when the fighting started. So that is how, you know, the Lord Dinka of Ibie were defeated in that, you know, that fighting. So we withdrew from that area, Ngolkong, those of Rumut. So from that time until the present time, Ibie area has never known peace or stability. People of Ibie got scattered all over the world. Sudan, South Sudan, in East Africa, you know, Europe, you know, everywhere. We are everywhere.
And you mentioned the people of Ibie have not gotten any peace. Recently, we've had reports where dozens of people were killed. And as we've been seeing, even just yesterday, as we planned this recording, there was an incident. Could you give an overview? What is happening? And in depth, what is this problem originating from, the violence that is happening there?
What happened on Saturday, 27th of January, 2024, was an attack on Ibie town in an area called Nyinukwach in Ibie town. That attack was carried out by members of a renegade called Guy Machek. And this Guy Machek is a commander of a militia, and he's based in Twitch County in Warab State, and he is an ally of a youth group from Twitch County. This youth group of Twitch has been carrying out attacks on southern areas of Ibie region since the 10th of February 2022, claiming that those areas of Anet and Agog and, you know, and the entire south of King River belongs to them. This is what they are saying. They have been trying all along to occupy all those areas, and that is why the fighting continued up to the last, you know, fight which took place in Abia town on Saturday, 27th of January. But then when that fighting in Abia town finished after 2 hours on Saturday, when they were driven out of Abia town by the mob youth fighters, just some few hours, the armed group of Twitch attacked a number of areas out of Abia, including Kadian, Jualjok. They also attacked Anet, but the attack on Anet was repulsed by the UNISFA, the UN peacekeepers, who are based in Anet, south of Abia region. So during that fight, the UN peacekeepers lost one of the members from Ghana. And then also there were more citizens who had come back from Kordofan, from southern Kordofan. They came through Mariang. They were transported from Vietnam. They were being accompanied by also. Then these guys were, you know, asked by the authorities in ruling state to accompany the civilians who were returning to Abia. But then they were ambushed when they reached Kolonganyang within Rumamir County, south of Abia region. So during that ambush, 14 people lost their lives. Yeah, so in total, the clashes which took place in Abia town and south of Abia areas, total number has reached 53, including two UN peacekeepers.
Okay. Now, what do you think is fueling this crisis from your point of view?
It is the claim by some few members of the Twitch community in Twitch County in Warab State that Anet belongs to them. And not only that, they are claiming that the entire area of south of Key River belongs to them. Not true. This is where I come from. Look at my age. You know, I'm 50. I'm 50 now, and I was born in that area. And this claim just came out of blue, just suddenly. As if somebody woke up from a sleep, somebody who has a nightmare. You know, when you have a nightmare, you know, you find yourself confused. You know, you find yourself in a confused situation. I think this is what is happening. But then, as a matter of fact, south of Abia River is a fertile land. The entire Abia region is fertile, but these areas in particular are very fertile, and we have water throughout the year. So I think that is one of the reasons, you know, which prompted some of our brothers from Twitch County to claim this area. They are determined, you know, to take it by all means, you know.
And now with issues of land disputes and such these things, the issue becomes complicated because you mentioned that Abia in itself is already a complicated issue. It's a disputed region between South Sudan and Sudan. And now you have another community who is claiming land to parts of this. What do you think are some actionable steps to curb what's going on in Abia? What can we do to solve these issues?
I think the solution is with our central government in Juba, especially His Excellency President Salva Kiir Mayardit, can stop this bloody conflict between two sisterly, you know, communities of Twitch and Ngok. You know, we have been living all along. We have never had any, you know, conflict. This is my first time to, you know, to experience such a conflict between our Twitch brothers and sisters. We never had any, you know, conflict with them. That's why I was telling you, just like a nightmare, somebody waking up from a sleep. So President Kiir and our central government in Juba has the key to end the bloodshed between the sisterly, you know, community.
On top of the government, you have different stakeholders there. So you mentioned the government can play a role in this. But now, do you think that the government, other stakeholders such as the UN and the international community, is doing enough to Abia? And what do you recommend for them to solve the issue of Abia?
That is a good question, my brother. You see, the other stakeholders, What they can do is, you know, let me start with our government in Juba, central government in Juba, led by His Excellency President Salva Kiir Mayardit and his members of his, you know, cabinet, even, you know, His Excellency, the first Vice President, Dr. Riek Machar, you know, was the head of the SPLM, SPLA, who led the team to The Hague in 2009, where the Abyei territory of the Nine Ngok Dinka Chiefdoms was defined by the Hague-based Permanent Court of Arbitration through a ruling which was issued on 22nd of July 2009. That verdict reduced the Abyei area into what we see now as the Abyei box. Parts of the Abyei area were cut off or chopped off from northern part of Abyei, eastern part of Abyei, and western part of Abyei. But southern part of Abyei was not touched because the southern part of Abyei, which is being claimed by our brothers and sisters in Tweed County in Warabi State, has never changed. If you review all the Sudanese old maps since the time of the British, when the Egypt and British were, you know, colonizing, ruling Sudan during the time of the Turkish, southern part of Abyei never changed. It remained the same. So, the ruling, the head court never altered any part of south of Abyei. So the stakeholders can do is to convince the government of Warabi State and also to, you know, remind our central government in Juba that the head box must be respected, because when the ruling was made, which reduced the Abyei area to what has become known as the Abyei box, it was accepted by all. Even some of our brothers from Tweed were present at The Hague when the ruling was made, and they accepted the ruling. Even our brother Madelang, delegates who accompanied His Excellency, the first Vice President, Dr. Riek Machar, to The Hague, among others. So there was no claim. There's never been any claim that southern part of Abyei belongs to Tweed. It has never happened. The international community, the government of South Sudan, the Warab state government, need to let our brothers and sisters understand our brothers and sisters in Tweed County that the ruling of The Hague must be respected. The Abyei box must be respected.
Mm-hmm. I want to read something to our listeners. There was an article written by Dr. Luca Byung on Radio Tamazo. So there's a paragraph here, and I'll read it verbatim. The 2011 Transitional Constitution of the New State of South Sudan, in its Article 1, defines the territory of the Republic of South Sudan to comprise all land and airspace that constituted the former southern provinces, three former southern provinces of Barkhazan, Equatoria, and Upper Nile, in their boundaries as they stood on January 1, 1956, and the Abyei area, the Abyei box, the territory of the Nine Ngok Dinka chiefdoms, transferred from Barkhazan province to Kordofan province in 1905, as defined by the Abyei Arbitration Tribunal Award of July 2009. In the event that the resolution of the final status of Abyei area results in the area becoming part of South Sudan. And this constitution also affords the people of Abyei the right to enjoy citizenship, nationality, and all the rights and freedoms guaranteed by the constitution. Now, I want to know, what is a legal argument from the communities of Tweed? What is their claim, and what evidence do they bring that this some of these areas belong to them?
This question, I think you can direct it to them. I cannot answer it on their behalf, because the reason which is driving them to claim this area is known to them, but I really don't know why they are just coming up with this claim, and I don't see any legal, you know, document which can support their claim. Because as I said before, the southern part of Abyei, if you look at the map, all the maps of Sudan before independence of Sudan until the independence of Sudan until the secession of South Sudan, the southern part of Abyei area remained the same. It has never changed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, on the final status of Abyei has been a hanging issue between South Sudan and Sudan, and it's been an issue that is controversial, and people have been avoiding the issue of Abyei. How do you believe that the final status of Abyei should be addressed? What is the solution? Because we are approaching now 20 years, next year will be 20 years since the signing of the CPA, the final signing in 2005, and we're currently 13 years into the independence of South Sudan. And with currently the things happening in Sudan and Abyei, the issue of Abyei has brought highlights. So my question is, how do we solve the issue of Abyei, the status of Abyei? What is your take?
The solution is not complicated, but it was made complicated by the parties which were supposed to have implemented. Starting with the Abyei Protocol, you know, Abyei Protocol suggested that at the end of the interim period, the 9 Lord English chiefdoms shall, you know, have their vote, you know, in a referendum, an internationally monitored or supervised referendum on the same day when the fellow Southern Sudanese by then voting for the secession of Southern Sudan. So the Lord Dinka were also supposed to vote on the same day, on the 9th of January 2011. But that did not happen because the former president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, and his party, the National Congress Party, objected the conduct of the Abyei referendum on that day. You know, they talked to our SPLM, SPLA leaders, trying to convince them not to allow the Abyei referendum to go ahead, so that if the Southern Sudan referendum, you know, takes place, then they would recognize the outcome. But if the SPLM, SPLA, and Southern Sudanese people by then insisted of having the two referendums concurrently on the same day, then they would not, you know, accept the outcome of the Southern Sudan referendum. So that's why the SPLM, SPLA, you know, convinced the Mob Dinka people of Abyei to wait until South Sudan guarantees its referendum and independence. And then after that, it would be very easy for an independent South Sudan to engage the Sudanese government on how to settle the Abyei issue. But then after independence of South Sudan, our brothers and sisters in the SPLM, SPLA, and in the government of South Sudan, you know, got engaged in internal power struggle, so they couldn't focus on the pending issues from the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, including the issue of Abyei. So that's how the issue, you know, was dragged on until today. As you asked about the solution, you know, in 2022, in July, I made a proposal giving a number of options on how to settle it once and for all. So I suggested that since Abyei was transferred by the British from Barzal province in southern Sudan in 1905 to Sudan, to Kordofan in Sudan, then the Sudanese government should also come up with a presidential decree, you know, transferring Abyei back to South Sudan. But if that one doesn't work, or if they don't accept it, then the second option is to recognize the outcome of the communal referendum which was held by the Ngok Dinka people of Abyei in October 2013, which was not recognized by the two, you know, the two Sudans. So the third option is to, you know, organize a new referendum supervised by the international community with acceptance of the two countries, whereby the 9 Lord Dinka chiefdoms will vote, you know, to decide, to choose whether they want Abyei to remain as part of Sudan or they want to rejoin their brothers and sisters in South Sudan. Yeah, but if that option is not also acceptable, then I suggested another option, that the 9 Lord Dinka chiefdoms cannot just wait indefinitely. As you mentioned, that we are almost approaching 2 decades now since the CPA was signed, and the issue of Abyei is still, you know, hanging in the air, and the Ngok Dinka people of Abyei are not able to settle in their homeland and, you know, go about their daily life, or, you know, plan their future, develop the area and live, you know, enjoy the dividends of peace. They are not able to have that. So the area is still being attacked. It used to be attacked by the Misiri Arabs and some, you know, elements from the Sudan Armed Forces. But those attacks, you know, stopped in 2022. So that the attacks which are ongoing are from our brothers from Tweed County. Yeah. So I suggested another option that the Mobinga people of Abia, instead of just waiting indefinitely, they must be given a right to have, you know, a self-rule, you know, system whereby they rule themselves within the territory of the nine Mobinga chiefdoms defined as defined by the Hague Permanent Court of Arbitration, so that they settle and arrange, you know, their programs and develop the area and have, you know,
so like be like an autonomous region.
Yeah, self-autonomous region. And I propose that the period should be for 6 years, and then you know, just 3 months before the end of 6 years, they can have a referendum to decide whether they want to join Sudan, or they want to join South Sudan, or they want to have their own independent, you know, state within the territory there, because they have that right to choose where they want to belong. Since the two governments, the government of Sudan is not able to provide them with the adequate security, and the government of South Sudan is unable also to provide them or to protect the area and to protect them from any attackers, whether from Sudan or South Sudan. So that's why if they are given that chance to have a self-autonomous region, then they will have a force which can allow them to protect their territory and their people, just like Kurdistan region in Iraq, something similar to Kurdistan region. They can also have something similar to Catalonia in Spain, or something like Zanzibar in Tanzania, you know.
And how have your proposals been received by many people?
You know, people are busy. They were still hoping that our government in Juba will try its level best to reach an acceptable, you know, solution with the government which took power in Khartoum after the revolution, 2018-2019. And according to what we were seeing, you know, the way talks were moving on, people were saying that there were hopes that the government of South Sudan, our government in South Sudan and the government in Khartoum, would reach a final solution to settle the Abia issue until you know, the fighting erupted in Khartoum in April last year. So since that time, you know, the attacks, you know, intensified from the side of our brothers and sisters in, you know, Tweed County, in Warab State.
And this is, many people say, South Sudanese, well, the people of Abia are in, they're getting the rights of South Sudan. They've had many key positions. They're represented. What more do they want? What do you say to people who say that?
You know, even if the sons and daughters of Abia are put in those positions, they are not brought because they are from Abia or they are Mobinga of Abia. They are brought to those positions as individuals, and they happen, and it happened, you know, by chance, to be members of the Mobinga people of Abia. Yeah, it depended on, you know, the contributions, you know, which they were making, you know, to further, you know, the interests of our nation, you know, you know, specific fields. Those who were given, you know, those positions, like, you know, Commander Pierre Dinkwal, when he was the Deputy Chief of Staff for Finance and Administration, Commander Kwal Dame Kwal, when he was the Deputy Chief of Staff for Logistics. Dr. Luka, you know, held a number of ministerial positions in the government of South Sudan. It was also based on his skills and expertise, and what he could, you know, contribute to the development of our nation, our country, our people. The same thing when Ambassador Rob Dengwalo, commonly known as Rob Harun, when he was our ambassador to Ethiopia and permanent representative to the African Union, it was based on his expertise within the region. The same thing with Dr. Francis Madinde when he was appointed by our president to be the first permanent representative to the United Nations in New York. It was based on his expertise. As you know, he has been working for the UN for so many years, and he could help our nation. So it was not based on being members of Ngok Dinka of Abia, but it happened by chance that these individuals were from Abia region. But by then, after they were all removed from their positions, that's when, this issue of the claim, the claim which has developed into, bloody conflict, it started, when some, individuals from our from Twitch County realized that now there are no, Ngok Dinka of Abia individuals in key positions in government of South Sudan institutions. So those few individuals took the advantage, that if we try this, the Ngok Dinka people of Abia will not be able to do anything because now they don't have a voice or they don't have any power, to protect the area. Yeah, which is, very unfortunate because, the protection of any citizen in South Sudan is a responsibility of our government, because we are all citizens of this nation, which we are proud of.
Yes.
So it is, a responsibility of our government to protect any citizen within our territorial integrity.
In this, you've shared a lot of good insights, and one of the things I would like to add is that as South Sudanese, we have this belief that when you have your sons or daughters in positions of government, and by main positions, particularly the executive ministerial positions, you're seen as, okay, well, you have these people, you shouldn't complain about your issues. But this doesn't necessarily mean I came there as a representative, because you might be solicited to be a key position because of your skills and your capabilities. We need somebody like a Colmeyen, and maybe people may not even know you're from Abia. But also, every citizen has the right to voice their concerns and share their feelings about what's happening in their area. And I think too often as South Sudanese, we equate that to being tribalistic. But you have a constituency. What you shared is a point of view and a perspective as somebody from Abia. You talked about Abia, the history from 1905 to 1956, and what happened. And you have recommendations, and you've been very active about this. It's your right. But nobody can dilute that by saying, well, you have people in the community. It's basically as if people of Wanchan have an issue, and they voice their concerns, and we tell them, well, no, His Excellency Salfakir Mayardi is the President of the Republic. Why are you complaining? But they may have legitimate concerns. We should listen to those concerns. The same thing if the people of Ler say we have issues, we say, no, you guys have Dr. Riek Machar as the first vice president. No, we have to stop looking at who's bringing the concerns and analyze the merits of the concerns and the complaints. And that's how you get to good governance. So I would like to wrap up. I want to know, what are some words of inspiration you have to journalists, authors, poets, and South Sudanese in general? How can you encourage them to forge ahead? Just a word of inspiration to people who may want to be writers, journalists, activists. I mean, what words of encouragement do you have for them?
Well, each and every one of us is gifted in one way or another, and in different areas. There are people who are gifted in public speaking, some in, in writing, poetry, short stories, novels, some are have wisdom. We are gifted in various areas, But then the environment where we find ourselves in sometimes, starting with the family and extended family members, sometimes we don't try to pay attention to discover the talents and skills in our children who are among us, so that we encourage them so that they develop these skills. Because after all, when a skill or a gift or, you know, talent is developed, it will be for the benefit of the nation and the people of South Sudan, and for humanity for that matter, because we also benefited from thinkers, writers, musicians from various countries. The world has become a global village, and we need to encourage, you know, we need to discover the talents in our children. And even there are people who are grown up, but they have talents, but they have not been told that you are talented in this or in that. So we need to let them know and also encourage them. If there is a way we can encourage them so that they develop, they start to believe in themselves, then develop the talents, so that he or she can help contribute to the development of the nation or to benefit humanity in that area, in that particular area.
Yes.
Because, you know, a talent does not have a tribe or a family or, you know, a race or color. We all benefit from any talented person, regardless of, you know, of their religion, age, gender, you know, background.
Yes.
Yeah. So I encourage our young people and even grown-up people who have not given themselves, you know, time to discover the talents which they have, yeah, and try to develop them. But we need to be, you know, good readers. We read extensively. Reading is very important. Yeah.
Yes. Reading is, and you being a writer, it's good to hear that. Reading is good. It clears your mind and it gets you informed and educated. Before we wrap up, where can some of our listeners find your books to get a deeper understanding of ABA?
My books are available now on Amazon.
Okay, yeah. On Amazon.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah. You guys, you go to Amazon, you can find the books. What if, okay, many people may not be living in the West. So where, if somebody's living in South Sudan, where can they find your books?
In South Sudan, you know, I took large numbers of copies, and they were being sold at our Juba International Airport, but the copies are out of stock now.
Okay.
But I will try my level best. If I, you know, print more copies, I will bring them over.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I will definitely bring copies. I want signed copies too. I'd want to keep those.
I will do so. I will do so. Yeah. I promised you last time.
Yes. I mean, I online, I read some of the books, you know, because when I was in the U.S., I'll find them on the, they have some paper, like the ebook.
Yeah.
Amazon, they have it. Yeah. So it was good. It was very good. I learned a lot, and I follow some of your writings, and even in the newspaper today, you wrote something. Even I that's the first thing I saw.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, when I get the newspaper. Today you wrote, you usually write in Mogif. You have your own column.
Yeah.
Because the good thing, you write in Arabic and in English.
Yeah.
So I usually, sometimes when I read in Arabic, I'll find your writings and very insightful. You're very creative and you write in both Arabic and English, which is good for many of our people. Good thing that this is an old newspaper, yeah. So I definitely, I tweeted one time. I tweeted at you. I'm like, hey, I read this article. It's very, very good. And I follow it. So I was like, yeah, I know this guy. So it was really inspiring. It's very good.
Thank you. Thank you, brother. Yeah. I try to write in two languages because, you know, South Sudan, our country, we have people who were brought up and grew up in Northern Sudan. And we have people who were brought up in our SPLM, SPLM liberated areas. Mm-hmm. And others were brought up in East Africa. So I want to give, you know, the two groups, you know, even those who lived in the West who are not familiar with the Arabic language, so that they can get my writings either in English or in Arabic. And I would even encourage our people, you know, to learn both languages. If you were brought up in an English, you know, environment, then it is important
to know Arabic.
Arabic and vice versa.
Yes.
Plus your mother tongue. And if you can also learn other, you know, our local national languages, you can learn, Acholi language, Nuer language, Anywa, Murle, that would be much better. It will bring us together as South Sudanese people. We will, mm-hmm. we will fight.
Yeah, and I think there's something that I don't understand this. So me, I went to the U.S. I was 5, and I came back to South Sudan. That was in 2000. Came back to South Sudan in 2017 when I finished school. And I came back, the first thing I did was I'm like, okay, I need to have an understanding of the local languages, Fistong or Jing or Arabic. So I would study aggressively, and I didn't even know how to read very well. So, and good thing also, I'd read the Quran, and then I just every day I read the newspaper. So if I find a word I don't know, I'd look it up. And then when I went to, I'd go to Rang, I'd go stay with my uncles and just practice speaking. Because, when you've been away for so long, you want to refine it. Yeah. And I tell people the most important thing, don't fear, you're learning something. So even when I read in Arabic sometimes, I'll watch the news and I write down words that I don't know.
Okay.
Like the other day, I was reading in the newspaper, and there was a word that I didn't know I knew. So they were talking about tadakhum fil alam, and I was like, "What is tadakhum?" I looked up; it was inflation. So I'm like, "Okay, that's interesting." So now I listen, and I can find tadakhum fi umlat al masriya, or tadakhum fil it's a different thing. This is basically, so you start getting confidence. So then I went and started looking up economic terms. So you'd be like, okay, you know what? Iqtisad, okay, the economy. Tamwil, istismar, all these different things. And you talk about daraib, faida. And I'm like, okay, you learned so much. And so I realized in a day, if you learn five, because me, I love language learning. I learned when I was in the U.S., I took Spanish, took French, even I'm learning Swahili. Because with language learning, it opens up your mind, And even it's kind of like when you learn a language, the beauty of the language is that your mind, it opens up in different ways, And many of us South Sudanese were blessed. You find somebody who, like yourself, you speak Tong Jing, you speak English, you speak Arabic. I think you speak Swahili. You speak all these different languages. And it helps you.
Yeah, that is right, when you speak a number of languages, it narrows the barrier, You find yourself along with the person you are talking to.
Yes.
That's why I encourage our people, especially the young people in South Sudan.
And many people are like, I don't want to learn Arabic. Why? It's a language. And even now with trade, even if you're somebody who wants to do business or be a professional, knowing multiple languages helps you. And I tell people, don't learn this local Arabi Juba. Go learn classical Arabic. Go learn to read and write. It's going to take time, but you give yourself 2-3 years and you'll be able to speak and you'll be able to develop yourself. So I got to give it to you. So listeners, you find him in English and Arabic. He's written books in English and Arabic. He writes in a newspaper in English and Arabic. So if those of you who don't speak English, you'll find it in Arabic. And those of you who don't speak Arabic, you can find it in English. So I think, guys, we're going to wrap up. So you guys follow Akol Mayen Kwal. He's on Twitter. He's on all social media platforms. You can go to Amazon, look him up, Akol Mayen Kwal. You find his books. His books are on Amazon. Sudan, Understanding the Oil-Rich Region of Ibie, The Last Train, The Sun Will Be Rising, Strategic Plans for South Sudan, and A Case for the Capacity of South Sudanese to Rule Themselves. And hopefully in the future, we get more books. We'll definitely be following. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter, Akol N Doc. That's me on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. Catch more insights from South Sudan and the world. And also, engage with us. When we publish these stories, share your thoughts, share your insights, and let us know who else we should interview. And let us know your thoughts and if you have any questions. If you have any questions about a BA or the BA box, feel free to reach out to our brother, Akol Mayen. Thank you guys for joining us. This was a great show. Have a great day. All the best.